And they classify that as the possibility of awakening the green ants, which are simply those beings that do not dwell on the surface. And when those things, this idea resurfaces, then a part of the illusion becomes reality because of that awakening. And the consequences of that awakening can be dastardly or it can move you on. So the fear is always that you will awaken that which will not allow you to spiritually progress, but destroy you and keep you locked into this illusion around you. Well, this gets as difficult to talk about as is light from an advanced mind gifted as, say, a Russell or a Tesla or what I'm trying to tell you. So in my efforts to explain these things, I like to start with a simple attitude about those things that some of you are working on, rather than try to explain the entire concept of you being light or illusion versus dream. If we get sidetracked onto all of these sidetracks and distractions, we're never going to make it through the tape to cake time, much less past dream time. But dream time ended, friends. Dream time ended in August, on the 17th day of August, 1987. You're in the new time of counting. That was a serious, serious clue. And if you want to play with this, I don't know where you're going to find it, because I just don't know where you're going to find it. But there is a movie made, and it deals with the green ants. And I think maybe it was Where the Green Ants Dream, or something of that sort. And it was basically about this dream time. And it's over. Dream time's over. And even those primitive Aboriginal people are waiting for the evolvement of the reality. And yet, any of you working in writing, storytelling, motion pictures, TV, anything, must begin to relate to those in that reality of dream. Because what you dream, you will become. And I'm not talking necessarily nightmares, but if nightmares is all you have, that's what you will produce. And obviously that is what the world has become, the nightmare. Because if your dream goals are always in progression toward God in perfection, you will make all those errors along the way that you call sins, for which you have to atone and play karma. These are illusions. You don't come back here to pay karma. I'm sorry. That may be a very high religious attitude, but it is incorrect. Do you have what is karma? Yes, you do, because you have whatever you are and you produce. And karma is simply something to rise beyond, to correct. So if you are lucky enough to know what was your shortfall and you are back to experience, that will be your focus so that you rise above those errors. I didn't say wrong, I said error. It may or may not be in the production of evil, remembering that evil defined is simply the pulling away from the direct course to God of goodness and righteousness by any means. And if you do that to someone else in your ignorance, you have done double evil, because you have distracted yourself, plus you pull somebody with you. So sometimes your opinions are a lot better kept to yourself. I think. Well, on what do you base your thought? Well, so-and-so said. Who is so-and-so? Oh, well, it was Hatton. I know now. It was Hatton who said it. Well, who's he? Now try to explain that one without being laughed off the globe. There's plenty of truth in fact, even in your illusion. And each one of you are going to look at each aspect according to as many individuals are in this room. Now, Mark, I want to focus not on all of these things, as might be in a great series of books wherein you achieve light, but at this moment, his knowledge must be in what he knows, and that is pollution control, plating, handling of these metals that in their instant state, their illusionary state, if you will, are deadly. And they're harmful to your environment. But they are totally necessary in their smallest, most minute form, their atomic level, to the etheric ascension of soul, the reality of soul. And I don't want to get into ideas, and I don't want to get into religion, and I don't want to get into dreams. Because right now, I need to deal with what goes into the Dria bottle. And I need to deal with what goes into the crop land. The land to give to the grain what it needs. So I don't want to go off there into vapor land and explain to every individual on the globe exactly what is an atom. I don't care whether you ever know or not. But I need my scientists to come along and stop trying to invade the overall and allow fulfillment of that which we need so we can build our stepping stones. I need it in such a way that Joe Blow in South Africa can possibly understand it if he says, God, I really need some insight into this. And when he really wants that insight, he's got it like that. Are we going to give it away to Mr. Trump? No, thank you. He's got enough toys to play with. So we have to keep our individual ideas from overflooding necessary focus. And my focus right now is just to get through this reading, get a report from Gene, and for goodness sakes, have some cake.
Right.
So please do not feel offended. Hold these ideas as the gnawing need they are, or you wouldn't ask about them.
Okay.
And they will get there. They will hit you.
Back to the subject here.
You're not here to sit around and just, you must be patient and you must wait. But you're not here for anything lesser than greatness. Any of you, not one of you.
Okay, I'll try again here.
Quit interrupting with intelligence, please.
Excuse me. Not often that happens.
We don't need him as a scientist. We need him to head the scientific department for the Institute. You see, he's a consummate teacher.
Okay, I'm going to back up a paragraph here. When you consider monatomic gold, for instance, the atom itself is quite elongated as the electron moves further and further from the nucleus and finally bursts outward. A diatomic circumstance simply exchanges electrons for lack of time for better description. When only the wave remains, you have achieved mono state. While I am defining this, for, I suppose, everyone, but more specifically for the attention of my team here who work with these substances every day, let us consider iridium and rhodium as they relate to their brethren element platinum. And later we will consider the transitions made in the octave gases of argon, krypton, and xenon. We will eventually move right on into the octave of niton. I'm going to stop for just a second here and just remind you that if you, those of you who can picture a periodic table of the elements, that these gases that Commander is talking about, and they include helium, neon, argon, krypton, xenon, and one that we call radioactive gas, radon, they sit off to the right and they're inert. Their shells, their electron shells are defined as filled, and as a result of that, they're completely inert. So from a scientific point of view, they are of very little interest.
I don't like hooking it up with radon, however.
Okay, well, we won't hook it up there. So I'm just saying that is in the conventional terminology.
Yes, it is. It certainly is.
And the important point here is that while scientists consider these inert and completely useless, they are, in fact, the most useful. So you can. I just wanted to show you how far science is from really understanding anything. Okay, back to Commander here. We will eventually discuss why you have no need for more than 9 octaves in elemental understanding. You need to save some lessons for the advanced state of being you are efforting to achieve, in essence, perfection. Now Commander goes into a discussion of several of these elements, including their atomic properties, and I'm not going to read all the atomic properties.
Oh, yes, you are.
I am?
Yes, you are.
You want me to read this into the book?
I certainly do.
Okay. Okay, iridium is the first one.
You are talking to a group in here. I have to get the information out there.
Okay. Iridium comes from the Latin iris, meaning rainbow. And Hatton comments, you will note that titanium, when brazed or heated properly, has the same characteristics of this rainbow coloring, and we will speak of this later. Now I have to translate some symbols for you. Iridium, the atomic weight of iridium is 192.22. And that is, I'll stop for a second and say here, that means that its weight is with respect to the idea of carbon has a weight. We've defined it as 12. And I won't go beyond that, just to say that carbon has
fine.
A weight of 12, and relative to carbon, this is at 192.22.
I have some people actually in South Africa waiting for these numbers.
Okay.
They know the symbology.
All right. The atomic number is 77. The melting point, do you want me to define all of these for them?
No.
Okay.
No.
The atomic number is 77. The melting point is 2410 degrees centigrade before iridium will melt. The boiling point of iridium is 4130 degrees centigrade, and the specific gravity is 22.42 at a temperature of 17 degrees centigrade. The valence of iridium is 3 or 4. The valence is what number of electrons want to fly away from the iridium and bond with something else, either 3 or 4 electrons. Hatton makes a comment here, no, I will not explain all the abbreviations, etc. You can go get those from primary chemistry charts, and we do not have time to teach pre-kindergarten. It's the end of his quoting. Then it gets back to the discussion here. Discovered in 1803 by Tennant, T-E-N-N-A-N-T, in the residue when crude platinum is dissolved by aqua regia, which is a reagent. And then Commander comes in again and says, mix one part concentrated nitric acid with three parts concentrated hydrochloric acid. This formula should include one volume of water if the aqua regia is to be stored for any length of time. Without water, objectionable quantities of chlorine and other gases are evolved.
See, I have to, and you might need to correct me from time to time, but aqua regia is a reagent that is very frequently used, and you'll hear it referred to. So I feel that there are some terms that I need to make clear to you. Go on, please.
Okay. I'm fixing a typo here. The name iridium is appropriate for its salts are highly colored. Iridium, a metal of the platinum family, is white, similar to platinum, but with a slight yellowish cast. It is very hard and brittle, making it very hard to machine or form or work. It is the most corrosion-resistant metal known, and was used in making the standard meter bar of Paris, which is a 90% platinum, 10% iridium alloy. This meter bar has since been replaced as a fundamental unit of length. And Commander comes in and says, the replacement is in the krypton category. Now back to the discussion. Iridium is not attacked by any of the acids nor by aqua regia, but is attacked by molten salts such as sodium chloride and sodium nitrate. Iridium occurs uncombined in nature with platinum and other metals of this family in alluvial deposits. It is recovered as a byproduct from the nickel mining industry. Iridium has found use in making crucibles and apparatus for use at high temperatures. It is also used for electrical contacts. Its principal use is as a hardening agent for platinum. With osmium, it forms an alloy which is used for tipping pens and compass bearings. The specific gravity of iridium is only very slightly lower than that of osmium, which has been generally credited as being the heaviest known element. Calculations of the densities of iridium and osmium from the space lattices give values of 22.65 and 22.61 grams per cubic centimeter, respectively. These values may be more reliable than actual physical measurements. At present, therefore, we know that either iridium or osmium is the densest known element, but the data do not yet allow selection between the two. Iridium costs about $300 per troy ounce. And Commander comes in at this point and says, in the 1960s, that is. We are using, as general reference for these elements, the Handbook of Chemistry and Physics, the 60th edition. No, I don't suggest that everyone simply go buy an updated volume that costs bazillions of dollars, and you won't generally know how to use it if you had it. Now, next element is rhodium. Rhodium comes from the Greek rhodon, which is rose. Rhodium's atomic weight is 102.9055. Its atomic number is 45. Its melting point is 1,966 plus or minus 3 degrees centigrade. Its boiling point is 3,727 plus or minus 100 degrees centigrade. Its specific gravity is 12.41 at 20 degrees centigrade, and its valence is 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6.
Now, when we talk about its boiling point or its evaporative change, you know, when water boils, it turns into steam. So when it vaporizes, let us call it temperature, when we refer to temperature, this is in the 3,000 range. Obviously, then, it's going to boil off more quickly than iridium. You've got to have another 1,000 degrees to then draw off the iridium. Go on, please.
Okay. Wollaston discovered rhodium in 1803 and 1804 in crude platinum ore he presumably obtained from South America. Rhodium occurs native with other platinum metals in river sands of the Urals and in North and South America. It is also found with other platinum metals in the copper-nickel sulfide ores of the Sudbury, Ontario region. Although the quantity occurring here is very small, the large tonnages of nickel processed make the recovery commercially feasible. The annual world production of rhodium is only 2 or 3 tons. The metal is silvery white, and at red heat slowly changes in air to the sesquioxide, meaning having 6 or 7 oxygens around it. At higher temperatures, it converts back to the element. Rhodium has a higher melting point and lower density than platinum. Its major use as an alloy agent to harden platinum is to harden platinum and palladium. Such alloys are used for furnace windings, thermocouple elements, bushings for glass fiber production, electrodes for aircraft spark plugs, and laboratory crucibles. It is useful as an electrical contact material as it has low electrical resistance, a low and stable contact resistance, and is highly resistant to corrosion. Plated rhodium produced by electroplating or evaporation is exceptionally hard and is used for optical instruments. It has a high reflectance and is hard and durable. Rhodium is also used for jewelry, for decoration, and as a catalyst. And Commander comes in at this point and said this is very important when it comes to the colloidal gold, and more important, the catalytic action in oxysol. This accounts for the rosy lavender hue of colloidal gold and the iridescent rainbow color of the iridium in atomic form in the various solutions. The point of oxysol, however, is to come up with the crystalline diamond transparency of a light solution. Now back to the discussion. Exposure to rhodium, metal fume, and dust should not exceed 0.1 milligrams per cubic meter in an 8-hour time weighted average 40-hour week. Soluble salts should not exceed 0.001 milligrams per cubic meter. Then Commander comes in and says, therefore, please note that any intaken rhodium needs to be in a colloidal state of molecular suspension. And then finally, in the discussion, rhodium costs about $450 per troy ounce in 1960s figures. Next element, titanium. Since titanium is the most current choice of the binding neck of the new viruses being pushed upon you, perhaps we need to look at the substance a bit more closely. Remember that the neck is the molecule that holds the brains or the cap of the virus to the crystalline body of the virus. Titanium comes from the Latin Titans, the first sons of the earth, in myth form. Titanium's atomic weight is 47.90, atomic number is 22. Its melting point is 1,660 plus or minus 10 degrees centigrade. Its boiling point is 3,287 degrees centigrade. Its specific gravity is 4.54, its valence 2, 3, or 4. It was discovered by Gregor in 1791 and named by Klaproth in 1795. Impure titanium was prepared by Nilsson and Peterson in 1887. However, the pure metal, 99.9%, and then Commander comes in here and says, see, you always have that extra hundredth, extra 100th percent never accounted for. However, it may come clear why less than 99.9% silver and gold are quite useful in colloids after all. Now, back to the sentence here. It says, however, the pure metal, 99.9%, was not made until 1910 by Hunter by heating titanium chloride with sodium in a steel bomb. Titanium is present in meteorites and in the sun. Rocks obtained during earlier Apollo missions show lower percentages. Titanium oxide bands are prominent in the spectra of M-type stars. The element is the ninth most abundant in the crust of the Earth. Titanium is almost always present in the igneous rocks and in the sediments derived from them. It occurs in the minerals rutile, ilmenite, and sphene, and is present in titanates and in many iron ores. Titanium is present in the ash of coal. And then there's a note here, pay attention, EJ. In plants and in the human body. The metal was a laboratory curiosity until Kroll in 1946 showed that titanium could be produced commercially by reducing titanium tetrachloride with magnesium. This method is largely used for producing the metal today. The metal can be purified by decomposing the iodide. Titanium, when pure, is a lustrous white metal. It has a low density, good strength, is easily fabricated, and has excellent corrosion resistance. It is ductile only when it is free of oxygen. The metal burns in air and is the only element that burns in nitrogen. Commander's notes here are very important. Titanium is resistant to dilute sulfuric and hydrochloric acid, most organic acids, most chlorine gas, and chloride solutions. Natural titanium consists of five isotopes with atomic masses from 46 to 50. All are stable. Four other unstable isotopes are known. Natural titanium is reported to become very radioactive after bombardment with deuterons. And Commander has that in bold. In other words, it's a good hint.
That's, yes.
The emitted rate.
We talk about heavy water, deuterium, right. So forth.
And so-called cold fusion. The emitted radiations are mostly positrons and hard gamma rays. The metal is dimorphic. The hexagonal A form changes to the cubic beta form very slowly at about 880 degrees centigrade. The metal combines with oxygen at red heat and chlorine at 550 degrees centigrade. Titanium is important as an alloying agent with aluminum, molybdenum, manganese, iron, and other metals. Alloys of titanium are principally used for aircraft and missiles where lightweight strength and ability to withstand extremes of temperature are important. Titanium is as strong as steel, but 45% lighter. It is 60% heavier than aluminum, but twice as strong. Titanium has potential use in desalinization plants for converting seawater into fresh water. And Commander comments here are also very important. A titanium anode coated with platinum has been used to provide cathodic protection from corrosion by salt water. Titanium metal is considered to be physiologically inert. And then Commander comes in here and says, perhaps the most important item for our uses at present. When pure, titanium dioxide is relatively clear and has an extremely high index of refraction with an optical dispersion higher than diamond. It is produced artificially for use as a gemstone, but it is relatively soft. Star sapphires and rubies exhibit their asterism as a result of the presence of titanium dioxide. Titanium dioxide is extensively used for both house paint and for artist's paint, as it is permanent and has good covering power. Titanium oxide pigment accounts for the largest use of the element. Titanium paint is an excellent reflector of infrared. And Commander comes in here and says, very, very important. And is extensively used in solar observatories where heat causes poor seeing conditions. Titanium tetrachloride is used to iridize glass. This compound fumes strongly in air and has been used to produce smoke screens. The price of titanium metal powder, 99.7% pure, is about $25 per pound in 1960s prices. Just a second. Okay, let us leave this Dharma. And by the way, readers, is there anyone out there who still wants Dharma's job? It is now getting right down to the nitty-gritty, where the reference books alone weigh some 35 to 40 pounds with the most tiny print available. When you desire another's job because it, quote, looks so good, perhaps you had better think again. And so, where are we going with all this? Why, right through the superconductors, where energy pours in one end and is never compromised, never used up, and always available out the other end. We are headed for allowances to know God and experience the wondrous phenomenon and mysteries of our most revered Creator. Isn't that, after all is said and done, the goal? If this is not your goal, please go follow the gang to mystical rapturization death. Good morning, and may insight strike you. Salute.
Thank you. We're off again. Off and running. But you see, with all the lessons in between, you're ready to take that on. The ones who need to understand will understand and be able to move forward. The rest will be able to understand that we're going to make it. And all the negative input in the world is not going to stop it. And the next question that you might have as revolving around the miraculous substance of monoatomic gold powder, for instance, is its superconductor capability. And when you utilize that in fuel cells, you can have an entire awakening and transition of the energy gain. And that's why it becomes so important as a commercial adventure for ones working on that and patenting those devices which allow for the precipitation out of this monoatomic powder substance. You see, as it's heated and different things are done to it, it becomes less than nothing. And it's very hard to read on any instrumentation. You don't have instrumentation for these qualifying statistics. So you're going to get sold a bunch of stuff, most of which will be like any other thing that has a good, substantial reason for working. It'll get sold on the commercial market as some other byproduct, and I can promise you this moment that it is not real. And you have no way of knowing. You can see if a colloid is a colloid. You will not be able to establish whether or not you have monoatomic gold. But utilized properly can give you energy while you're on your way to absolutely and totally free energy. So let's remember, it is not its substance itself. It's its capability of being a superconductor. And that is in the energy field. What it does in the body is far more important, but we're not going to get hung up on that right now. So, Jean, would you please give us an update on whatever you might have, and then we'll take a break.
Commander, could I ask a question?
It is not too complicated.
It's not too complicated. The miracle of these products, as you stated, and the Dreas are the only ones who have those. Other companies, Interlight, etc., are putting out colloidals. I'm wondering if the true value of these colloidals could be marketed through another highly integrity multi-level organization that I work with.
Anyone who wants to do that, as long as we can meet the demand. Because these are very substantially, well, yes, they're just good products. And as with the Gyandrianas, they're not going to be able to be analyzed so that you can break, you know, this is what a chemist wants to do, is break down every last little thing. and you're going to find new elements in some of our products. And you see the Driyas themselves, because of their structure of cellular life, they are structured to take gold particulate and change it into monoatomic structure. But you can't break it down. So our need to be very careful with any kind of advertising is that you don't do anything. Already, you see, when I speak to someone, I spoke to Miss Kennedy about her Crohn's disease and so forth. And it wasn't any time until they'd confiscated stuff at the Canadian border. Did it have anything to do one with another? Yes, it did, simply because, you see, as people turn toward something that works, the government starts trying to shut it down on any pretext whatsoever. And if they can come back and say, well, I don't care whether it's her or some unseen energy form, it doesn't matter to us. We're going to pull these products. Do you see how it deprives everybody? And I do not intend, for the sake of a few sales out there, or to help some people that are just as happy with something else, I'm not going to jeopardize our products by playing that game anymore. I'm working with one, and we're doing absolutely everything that we can publish right in the paper. And we have the baby that is extremely sick and will not live if some intervention is not taken place here. Well, I can't tell. I can tell everybody what I might do if I were there with you and I had such and such products available to me. And here is a good opportunity to say that that baby is close enough to Wendell Hoffman that some of his energy transference apparatus might work. So he needs the information, as was sent to us, with a way to get in touch with this family and allow him to take that further within his realm of capabilities that I may not even mention in a publication or discuss in any form as an authority, or I am practicing medicine. And I'm doing so without a license. And I'm not. I have no interest in your medical associations. I'm not in competition. I would like to see ones have life. And I will help where I can. And I believe that you will begin to see a difference in this child as you structure in to the DNA structure of the cellular Driyas and then present them to the child's body to be able to reclaim. Will it work? We'll see. They seem to want to try that. I can't even hold their hand while they try it.
One of the scientists for this company that I'm thinking of wrote an article in the Contact, so there is some respect there. Are you saying it's okay then to introduce the possibility of a joint venture for certain of these products to expand?
Oh, yes. You're certainly welcome to do that.
Dream I had when I was a couple of weeks ago when I was asking questions about the Philippines and this gold, et cetera, and getting lost in that dream one night. Muktananda came, and among other people we met at that meeting, said, we know where the gold is. Now, I didn't go any further with that, but I just had a curiosity what that Baba was doing in your realms, or if you know him or meet him.
No, but I know where the gold is.
Now, I'm not going to ask you where.
Thank you.
I'm not going to ask where it's at.
Thank you.
This is the great being, Gene Dixon.
Thank you. Is this thing on?
No.
Don't do that to me. As a matter of fact, I have a feeling that this last discussion was very erudite. I have to admit that some of it was over my head. Quite a bit of it. I'm still out there with the Indian chief banging the drums, and I think he's got a pretty good idea.
You just keep your eye on the law.
All right. I'm happy to tell you that the pro se law school is about to get off the ground. We have received some 35 books from Nolo Press. We intend to use those as the textbooks. I have been very diligently and religiously taking those things apart for the last 2 weeks. You can tell by the bags under my eyes that that's what I've been doing. I'm trying to structure everything into a number of classes and how to gain the most out of the book. And starting tomorrow, persons who wish to sign up for this pro se class can see Valerie, and Valerie will have forms to be filled out. We need to know what your times are, when you think you can best appear, what you're looking for, where is it going to be, things like that. Practical things. I'm happy to tell you that on the 23rd and 24th of March, if we can get a couple classes under our belt, they're the law students in California, and these are the select law students who've been selected for arguing moot matters before the appellate court, are going to be having a moot court hearing in Kern County in the Superior Courts in Bakersfield. If we can get enough interest, we'll make arrangements to get down there and listen to those students, to be top students, arguing issues that we might be interested in. And we'll have the benefit of my having been able to get some information on the issues before we get there, and we'll take it apart and see how close we are to matching what they're arguing about, and then we'll critique them and critique ourselves. So that might be kind of interesting.
Let's have fun. And let's start by asking Mr. Dixon to explain the difference in moot and mute.
Moot and mute. In law, a moot court is where the issue is already decided. And it's just it's a court hearing. There will be appellate judges there. And the students who will be appearing before them are taking cases where the issues have already been decided. And it's up to these students to argue their positions and hopefully come up with innovative other issues, good sound arguments. It's like an attorney appearing before the appellate courts. Now, mute is just when you stand mute. You don't respond.
That's rarely, Gene.
All right. Now, a few weeks ago, we got a call from the FDA, and they had, through interception of an unclaimed package, it picked up an item mailed by the Gaia Products, new Gaia Products, and it contained some colloidal silver. I think it was Gaiacol. And they wanted more information on that subject. So I did a lot of research on it. I went to all the libraries, pulled out all the encyclopedias and the medical journals and treatises, and came up with some information. And Ed Young did a fantastic job with the letter. And in several conferences with the FDA this week, and Mr. Michael Wirth, the gentleman who initiated the investigation, he informed me that he was very pleased with our work, and he was dropping any investigation whatsoever, and he was perfectly satisfied with the product as he saw it. That's all very good news.
That's good news.
But in doing that research, I came upon a book called Colloidal Silver. And let me read you a few parts of that book. It's really interesting and really right on what the commander was saying. This is from the introduction. And this is a 1995 publication.
You sure we didn't write it?
No, this was written by a fellow by the name of Baranowski. Zane Baranowski. He's a certified nutritionist. He's a lecturer, a seminar speaker. He has offices in Colorado and other places. He says in the introduction, antibiotic-resistant germs are now considered epidemic in the United States, accounting for a growing number of serious infection disorders. While most antibiotics disinfect about a half dozen or so germs, silver has been reported to disinfect hundreds. Most importantly, unlike conventional antibiotics, germs cannot build a resistance to the action of silver. A properly prepared colloid of silver is a special liquid preparation of this trace mineral that is extremely safe to use, even with children, without many of the negative side effects of prescription antibiotics. When properly prepared, Colloidal silver is a completely non-toxic, tasteless, internally and externally applicable, broad-spectrum germ, germ fighter and disinfectant, which can significantly reduce the length and severity of many bacterial infections. For these reasons and more, colloidal silver should prove to be one of the present and greatest discoveries in preventative natural health care of all time. Let's see, there was some more here somewhere. Page 8. It's called Rediscovering the Universal Antimicrobial. Silver is one of the most universal antibiotic substances. When administered in the colloidal form, it is for all practical purposes non-toxic. Silver has been proven to be useful against hundreds of infectious conditions. Although the exact mechanism for the proven antimicrobial effects of silver is unknown. The most accepted theory is that silver disables a specific enzyme that many forms of bacteria, viruses, and fungi utilize for their metabolism. All right. And how do you know it's... This is what I found really interesting here. The visual qualities. How do you know that the liquid that you have is a good mixture? One indication of the quality of colloidal silver is the color. As the size of each silver particle gets larger, the color of the suspension ranges from yellow, which is best, it says, this is their word, yellow is best, to brown, to red, to gray, or to black, which is considered very inferior. If you remember, the silver colloidal that we have is near yellow. That's ranked best according to this expert here. Okie dokie. Now on Wednesday of this coming week, 3/13/96, in Reno, Nevada, the trustee in bankruptcy in the American West Publishing case has filed a motion against American West Publisher and George Green to throw their bankruptcy out of court. We have joined in that petition to have the bankruptcy dismissed. We want to get that. This involves the bookcase, really.